might need to do some educating of people and continue to do some educating to remind people unions built the middle class in this country. People have a five-day work week because of unions. People have sick leave because of unions. People have an eight-hour work day because of unions. People have health care because of unions. People have safe working conditions because of unions.
So at my day job, where I drive truck, I have one open claim right now for an injury that I received at work. My wife says I probably should not have that injury, which is lifelong. It doesn't stop me from doing anything, but boy, it sure sucks to have it. Of course, she likes to point out that maybe I wouldn't have it if I weren't at that job because I don't belong at that job. But as I've stated here on this microphone before, it's tough to leave with the health insurance and some of these other things. Mayor Pete said something interesting this week to me that, well, the boy was just really singing my song. And he said, if you are stuck at your employer because you cannot get health care on the open market, then you are not free. Now, Mayor Pete is taking a lot of heat right now because the people that work for Mayor Pete do not have health insurance. And as Mayor Pete pointed out, he said, we started with this little campaign. And then before you knew it, it just was gigantic. And it's true. It's what happened to him. And he says, you have to have at least 50 employees in order to have to provide health care to your employees under Obamacare. Which begs the question, wow, he did this well and he went this far and he doesn't even have 50 employees. So anyway, he's remedying that right now. But it is one of the things that holds me up. And I work a lot. I like to think that I work pretty damn hard. And on the heels of this injury, which I am still getting over, about 2 weeks ago, I was loading pipe onto the back of a truck. I feel like I've told this story before. No, this is a whole different thing. And I had a piece of lumber that I was setting on the bed drop and smash my finger. And the first thing I did was to hide. It took a chunk out of my finger. When you have that kind of pain, I don't know about your body, but my body immediately goes into a level of shock. And I felt dizzy. And I got out of the way. I got out of everybody's way. And I disappeared. And I just went somewhere to quietly sit down, throw my head back, and scream silently into the air with really, really terrible pain as I held my hand. Once it subsided a little bit, I went ahead and I took a look and I said, ugh, okay, that's not too bad. Could put a Band-Aid on that, but that's what I said about the last thing, and it took a hell of a lot more than a Band-Aid. I sat there for about 5 minutes. I let my dizzy spell go away. I let my focus come back. I didn't feel so flushed anymore. Stood up. Very, very quietly walked to the first aid box. Grabbed that Band-Aid and some ointment. Put it on my finger. Right back to work. Looked around to make sure that nobody saw anything. My concern was not to immediately take care of myself. My concern wasn't even to immediately stop working. My concern was that nobody saw what happened. Because I've got a fear that if it happens too much, I'll get dropped. And then I really won't have health insurance. And what the F kind of thing is that? For me, working was my ticket. My ticket out of the ghetto. And I said, once I get there, I'm going to work as hard as soon as I'm old enough. I'm going to work as hard as I can. I'm going to make some money. And then I'm going to be fine. It was my way out. And I was always told, you got to work hard. And I was like, okay, I'm going to work hard. You got to be productive. All right, I'm going to be productive. And what I didn't realize was that those lessons were effectively teaching me to be a drone, a worker bee, and not much else. See, the culture here in America is a little different than what it is in Europe. They don't do 40-hour work weeks. And they've got about 5 or 6 weeks of vacation a year. And you go, oh, my God, Melvin, they're so lazy. They're not lazy. They strike a very important work-life balance. I saw a tweet recently that just knocked me over. I don't read a lot of tweets, but this one in particular really got me thinking. And it said, how to know that you've internalized capitalism. 1, you determine your worth based on your productivity. Yeah, I do that. I'm not working if I'm not being productive. Effectively, right now, I've got 3 jobs. But with the podcast going away, soon I'll only have 2. But as long as I'm producing something, that's I feel worthy. You feel guilty for resting. 2, not a moment passes when I'm sitting there and relaxing, where I'm not thinking, you know what, while I'm sitting here relaxing, what else could I be getting done? 3, your primary concern is to make yourself profitable. If it don't make dollars, it don't make sense. That's a thing. I'm always finding a way to make money. You neglect your health. I've gone into the hospital any number of times, and after a full body rundown, they can't find a damn thing. And then they'll say, hey, it's stress. You're working too much. There's some things that cannot be measured with these machines. But sir, you'd better slow down. And 5, you think that hard work is what brings happiness. I'm guilty of those. Guilty of all 5. That comes from @Rosewater. On Twitter. And I thought, how did I get this way? And perhaps you say, well, Melvin, you know, I'm not like that. I don't think that way. Well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Take a look at some of our conservative friends. They are uber guilty of this. When you mention the idea of the Europeans having 6 weeks of vacation, we can't afford it. Yeah, we can. We can afford that. But what we don't want to do is we don't want for our rich white CEOs to have to pay for that. Because if they make $10 million instead of, say, $12 or $13 or $14 million, they might not survive. And our interests have now become the interests of our opulent overlords. Think about the folks that are on welfare. My mother, who was on welfare, used to complain about people on welfare. She probably still does. I don't talk to her anymore, though. My father. I was on welfare growing up because my father wasn't there. Effectively his fault that I was on welfare. He complains about people on welfare. I don't know that he's ever been on it, but he complains about people on welfare. I don't complain about people on welfare. If you make $50,000 a year, and I'm just going to use this as the marker, sort of the gauge. If you make $50,000 a year, you are paying about $40 into the welfare system. And what does that do? For people that cannot work, for people that cannot eat, for people that do not have a place to live, it gives them all of those things, you know, like Jesus would do. I don't care. Take the $40, take the $80, take a couple of $100 from me. I don't care. I would far rather have those people eating, and I don't care if they're not working. If they're here and they're alive and we are a Christian nation, then we should be taking care of them, not making excuses for why we should not. And I don't care what it costs. So my question to you is this. Is it a failure of capitalism that there are so many homeless people in the streets? Is it a failure of capitalism that we spend way more than any other country in the world on our health care? And it doesn't cover everybody and we have far worse outcomes. How about college debt? Let's just privatize college debt. And that'll make everything better. And let's make it so that it can't be discharged through bankruptcy. Let's sell them on how bad they need to go to college, and they do. College is great. Let's sell them on how bad they need to go to college, and not just any college, that college, their parents' alma mater, or this college that their friend went to. You know, make it like a branding thing and have them take out $80,000 a year in loans to go. Whatever it takes. How about that? We privatize that. Is that a failure of capitalism? I would say that all of these things are exactly that. And I've got a really prime example right here. So this comes from CNET, and I'm pulling a ton of stories from CNET these days. The headline, Amazon fired these 7 pregnant workers. Then came the lawsuits. This by Alfred Ng and Ben Fox Rubin over at CNET from just a couple of weeks ago. Quoting here, Rosales knew she'd have to start taking more restroom breaks. And she was already worried about her bosses at Amazon's Golden State Fulfillment Center. Worried that they would have an issue. During her 10-hour shift as a tote auditor, she would scan items and fill up a bag and send them along to the next person. She claims those fears were justified. She said her bosses hassled her about how much time she was using to go to the bathroom and how her work pace had slowed during her pregnancy. Hey, Amazon, perhaps she's just making another drone for you. Have you considered that? Nearly a week after Amazon's Cyber Monday rush in November, its biggest shopping day ever, the world's largest online retailer fired her, ending her 2-year tenure at the 950,000-square-foot San Bernardino, California facility less than 2 months had passed since she told her managers that she was pregnant. Similar to at least half a dozen other women who have worked at Amazon's warehouses, she earned $15 an hour, and she is now suing them, claiming discrimination. CNET reviewed 7 lawsuits against Amazon filed by pregnant warehouse workers who that were filed over the last 8 years and who have alleged that the company failed to accommodate their needs. The requests included longer bathroom breaks with fewer continuous hours on their feet, according to the lawsuits. But in all the cases, the expectant mothers were fired after telling their managers that they were pregnant. 6 of the cases were settled out of court. Rosales is in court right now. Apropos to what I mentioned earlier. If you are not working hard, then you must not be happy. If you are not being productive, then you have little to no worth. See, just this week, there was a strike by people that work for Lyft and people that work for Uber. And what they said was they are not getting the pay that they deserve, right? They are not getting the benefits that they deserve, and that they need to be treated better than this. Oh, I agree. Oh, I absolutely agree. And the reason they chose this week is because Lyft is already a public company, but Uber is going public as well. And Uber stands to make a lot of money when they start selling shares. And these folks have said, hey, we the workers would like a piece of that. But of course, it is very unlikely to happen. Why is that? Let me tell you how we ended up in this exact spot with respect to how we are treated as workers. Post-World War II, our country was largely, and I mean largely, unionized. And the middle class grew at an astounding rate. It has never grown faster than it did post-World War II. People were a part of unions. People had pensions. People had benefits. They had money to take vacations. They had money to buy cars. It was fab. But then something happened. I think during the 60s, especially with Richard Nixon and with what happened with Vietnam and LBJ, faith in government began to erode a little bit, and that's okay. Every so often, dumpy ass people are going to get into government. We can't get away from that. You know, it takes all kinds to make a government. The government should look like the country looks like. You know, if it's a lot of young people, it should be a lot of young people in government. It's a lot of old people, it should be a lot of old people in government. You know, white people, black people, Asian people. If there's a lot of those, then there should be a lot of those in government. Your government should look like the rest of your country. And America, just like any other country, has some dumpy-ass people. So it's going to be some dumpy-ass people in government. So what we should have seen the Richard Nixon era as is a phase. Hey, you know what? We're just going through a rough patch. This isn't the way things are. But then over in California, there was another thing happening. There was sort of a Nixon light happening in California with Governor Reagan. And his was the same thing. He didn't think that there should be money for all these poor people. He didn't think that there should be money for mental health. You know, put those damn people out on the streets. He didn't think that we should have health care benefits. Well, why should some rich CEO have to pay for you to have health care benefits? But then something else happened. Nixon got booted out, which, okay, look, all right, good. It was supposed to happen. But it did erode trust a little bit in government. And then Ronnie Reagan started running for president. And he put it to you like this. The worst words, what is it, the 11 words or the 7 words, I forget what it is. The worst words, the scariest words in the English language, scariest phrase in the English language is what? I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. And people said, yeah. And born was the idea that we are not the government. That the government is this far away, untouchable, deep state, monolithic thing that is not at all connected with us, which is not true because it is. The government is us. But at that moment, we started, no, it's not us. God dang it, he's so right. And then they started killing unions. And then they started fighting against workers' wages. And then they started getting rid of pensions. And all along the way, they said, this is what you have to do. Because free markets mean free people. And if you have health care and you've got pension and you've got benefits, you are not a free person. That was the argument that was made. And we in America bought it. What helped us buy that particular argument? Well, television. Look at just about any movie from the 80s, and you will hear tons of jokes about how terrible the government is and how fabulous Wall Street is. Hell, there was even a movie where they didn't even try to hide it called Wall Street. It was made. And then there's Risky Business. You know, all these, they go, look. You can go into these boardrooms and you can go onto the floor of the stock exchange. You can dare to be rich. You don't need the government. You don't need to worry about other people. And every president that we've had since then, and both political parties, have been of the mind that, you know what? We're with them. Maybe you don't need the government. Maybe you need less government in your life. Hell, I like Bill Clinton. But even Bill Clinton ran on the idea that we need less government. There's less government in your life. What are you doing, Billy? And so now that's the thing. And then George W. Bush comes along and he goes, less government. And Barack Obama did a lot of the same thing. And Obamacare, may I remind you, Obamacare was a conservative idea. And we fought for it. Now, better than the alternative, for sure. Hell, I fought for Obama right here on this Obamacare right here on this microphone. But it wasn't supposed to be the end game. It's supposed to be a step in the right direction. And that's how we ended up making far less money per hour than we should be making, with far fewer benefits, with more and more people slipping through the cracks all the time. And what is the argument that we're having right here, right now, with this president, our current president? We're fighting over whether or not we need another tax cut. Of course, they're trying to sell it to us. It's tax cuts for you, America. But it's not for us. And we know it's not for us. It's another tax cut for Trump and all of his rich friends. That's it. That's all it is. You can say, Melvin, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't hear that argument being had anywhere. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you do. Oh, yeah, you do. Anytime you hear someone say, government is the problem. Anytime you hear someone say, unions are the problem. Anytime you hear somebody say, we should privatize Social Security. Anytime that you hear somebody say, hey,
These damn kids have borrowed money for school. It's their own damn fault. They should have known better. All you're hearing are arguments against us. Arguments against us as the government. Arguments against we bettering ourselves. And the fact that we've accepted this for so long is insane to me. And I'm not the only one that sees it. I'm just the only one saying anything about it. Unions. Kamala Harris is on the road and she's talking about unions. And all the progressive candidates, all the good progressive candidates, I'm not talking about Klobuchar, are talking about health care for all. And they're all talking about raising wages. And we are finally over this stupid Reagan hump and these dumpy ass politicians. But hey, it's only going to get better if you stay engaged. I don't care where you're at on the economic ladder. You will be at the bottom. And you will be without eventually, unless you join with the rest of us, working people.
Congresswoman Omar sent out a release last night saying that your tweet from a couple of days ago has led to direct threats on her life. Any second thoughts about that tweet and the way it was produced and put together?
No, not at all. Look, she's been very disrespectful to this country. She's been very disrespectful, frankly, to Israel. She is somebody that doesn't really understand, I think, life, real life, what it's all about. It's unfortunate. She's got a way about her that's very, very bad, I think, for our country. I think she's extremely unpatriotic and extremely disrespectful to our country.
Let me tell you what you just heard. You just heard the president of the United States, okay, say he doesn't regret sending out these tweets that got a congresswoman's life threatened. Could you imagine President Obama saying that? President Obama sent out a tweet about a congresswoman that he did not like. That congresswoman began getting death threats, tons and tons of death threats. And they said, hey, Mr. Obama, do you think it was okay for you to send out that tweet that's getting her all these death threats? And he said, no, are you fucking kidding me? Do you know what would happen to him? But it's the president. It's President Trump. And so it's okay. It's okay for him to say that he is totally cool with Ilhan Omar getting death threats because of the tweets that he sent out. I've maintained for a long damn time on this microphone that, okay, Islamic terrorism, there's an issue there. America really started those fires and continues to stoke them. We should be making friends with that community rather than demonizing them. That's what you see. I learned something. The guy that runs Life After Hate, his name is Christian. I forget his last name. He was one of the first people to point out to me, these folks just need a place to belong. And these groups give them a place to belong. I remember living in San Diego, California, and I used to watch the things that would come on the nightly news about gangs, and they would go, hey, these people just need a place to belong. When somebody's lost, when somebody's wayward, when somebody doesn't have a family, they will find a place to belong in these extremist groups. So if there are folks in that group, you know, in Islamic groups that are lost and they don't know where to go, and reach out to them. That's a better way to handle that. But instead, we've demonized them and targeted them. And the president of the United States is hoping for their assassination, has even said out loud that we should ban them from coming to America, banning a religion from these folks that piss and moan so loudly about freedom of religion. But I don't think the Islamic terror is the real problem. It's a problem. But there's a much larger one that we're not paying any attention to. I want to bring you inside the world of 4chan and 8chan. So you may have heard of these groups before. And what these effectively are is these are the dark web. These are the clogged sewer of the internet. Sorry, I probably should have warned you that I was going to be super gross. Hey guys, I'm going to be super gross. Okay, now I'm done being super gross. The headline on this article from the Daily Beast, America is under attack by white supremacists who are acting like ISIS. Now, if we're so concerned about ISIS, maybe we should be concerned about these groups as well. Quoting here, moments before allegedly opening fire at worshipers in Shabbat of Poway, white supremacist John Ernest previewed his plans on 8chan, just as his supposed inspiration did. Last month, the white supremacist in Christchurch, New Zealand, used 8chan to share a link to a live stream of him killing 50 Muslims at a mosque. In between the attacks, the anonymous forum with a large fascist presence called for people to carry out more shootings. The calls for violence also spread across fringe groups like Gab and messaging apps like Telegram. It's reminiscent of calls online for the followers of ISIS and Al-Qaeda to strike out at the enemy, according to counter-terrorism experts. After the New Zealand shooting, 8chan users decorated the serial killer as a saint and encouraged others to commit shootings on their own, including against synagogues, to prepare for the Third World War against Jews, or just go kill a journalist who is critical of the forum. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not a journalist, but I'm definitely critical of the forum. I'm going to end up on a hit list, and I don't care. Quote, we've fretted so much about Al-Qaeda and ISIS online, and we've got a massive white supremacist network online right now. That, according to ex-FBI agent Clint Watts.
Been on a 10-year trajectory. We've seen increasing levels of this talk, both online and on the ground in terms of protests. But what really sticks out is what's happened over the last 2 years. We used to talk about domestic terrorism. They were capable. They had access to targets, but they weren't motivated to violence. They wouldn't actually commit the acts. In the last 2 years, that has changed significantly, not just in the United States, around the world. And we act as if each of these attacks are one-offs, but they are not. They network online just like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. They share their tactics, techniques, and procedures. They offer manifestos to each other as guidance in terms of what their targeting should be, who they should target, why they should target. And this is a network that, unless we get into this, unless we start to bring all these threads together, we will continue to react to these attacks. If you go to the FBI, they're using a totally different rule set on domestic terrorism versus international terrorism. We use the national security guidelines to go after Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We opened up large-scale investigations where we allowed them to preemptively go in and start to look at FISAs, starting to look at their online activity. And anybody that so much has touched the word ISIS or Al-Qaeda would be looked at, visited, interviewed to see what their connections might be. Instead, what we do is we wait for an attack right now. We go out, we see the damage, and act like, oh, just some bad apple. They are not bad apples. In fact, they know each other.
Quoting here, those real-life actions appear to have spiked over the last 6 months, with at least three white supremacists announcing attack plans on 8chan or on Gab before opening fire at a Jewish or Muslim house of worship. Three such attacks at the Pittsburgh Synagogue, Christ Church Mosque, and the Poway Synagogue have killed a combined 62 people in the past 6 months. That background noise can act as a war drum for violence. White supremacist communities often use memes to normalize extreme violence. Almost immediately after the San Diego shooter warned of his attack on 8chan, forum goers treated the mass shooting like a game. The first response to his 8chan post urged him to get the high score. Investigative outlet Bellicat noted, when only one person, 60-year-old Lori Gilbert Kai, was murdered, some 8chan users lamented the attack's low score. This is real. So they talk about it on the forum. They say you have to get the high score. What does that mean? You have to go into the church, the mosque, or the synagogue. You have to kill as many people as possible. That's what they mean by getting the high score. And if you get the high score, then you are crowned a saint on 8chan. This is the Al-Qaeda network. This is the ISIS network, but it's the white version of it. It's full of Trump's people. And when Trump praises these people, when he defends these people, they're emboldened even further. And I don't want to hear, well, he's decried. No, he has not. And as a matter of fact, a bunch of these white supremacists were kicked off of a bunch of social media networks last weekend. And what did this president do? He immediately went on Twitter and defended them as being kicked off because they're conservative. No, sir. They're being kicked off because they're anti-Semitic, because they're racist, and because they're committing murder. Perhaps the White House could do something about this, but they're not going to. Why? Because these are his supporters. And they're white. And what they're doing is okay. And just to put a fine point on that, the Office of Domestic Terrorism has been completely de-staffed. There's nobody working on it. Brown people committing terror? Yeah. Oh yeah, that's terror. That's real terror. We got to go after that. White people doing it? These are lone wolves. They're not lone wolves. The things that they're using, the weapons that they're using, the tactics that they're using, the online forums that they are using are exactly the same as ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I've maintained for a long time that this is one of the reasons why they don't want to get rid of their guns. And I'm not saying get rid of all guns. No one's making that argument. But the weapons of war, we do not need them. You do not need them for self-defense. You do not need them for hunting. Let's get rid of the weapons of war. And the Democrats are in the House right now. And there have been some votes against those weapons of war. Not all guns, just the weapons of war. Eric Swalwell is a congressman. He's a Democratic congressman. He's running for president. And he got a call to his office after voting to get rid of these weapons of war. This happened just a few weeks ago. This is the voicemail. I'm going to play it now. This is the voicemail that was released by his office.
Eric Swalwell, here's a little ditty for you. Pop, 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 pop. 30-round clip, you're all going to drop. And I don't give a f*** anymore. You motherfuckers think you got some new young motherfuckers going to take over and f*** the Constitution? F*** you. You want to go to war, motherfucker? We're going to war, and you're going to be the first motherfucking casualty. F*** you.
Aw, kind of makes me miss my dad. So the headline here is, why won't Twitter treat white supremacy like ISIS? I mean, when they're clearly using the same tactics, the same language, the same support groups, why won't Twitter? And I've said for a while, I said, Jack Ryan's got to be a white supremacist. I think it's Jack Ryan, the guy that heads up Twitter. I'm not going to look it up right now. As you can hear, I'm hot. I'm a little bit pissed. Might be Jack Conway. Anyway, I've said, you know what? He won't kick off these white supremacists, and he won't kick off Donald Trump when Donald Trump is inciting violence, including against Ilhan Omar. The guy's got to be a white supremacist. But then I read this headline. A Twitter employee who works on machine learning believes that a proactive algorithm solution to white supremacy would also catch Republican politicians. Quoting here, at a Twitter all-hands meeting on March 22nd, an employee asked a blunt question. Twitter has largely eradicated Islamic State propaganda off of its platform. Why can't it do the same for white supremacist content? An executive responded by explaining that Twitter follows the law, and a technical employee who works on the machine learning and artificial intelligence issues went up to the mic to add some context. With every sort of content filter, there's a trade-off, he explained. When a platform aggressively enforces against ISIS content, for instance, it can also flag innocent accounts as well, such as Arab language broadcasters. Society in general accepts that the benefit of banning ISIS for inconveniencing some others, he said. In separate discussions verified by Motherboard, this is Motherboard by Vice, that employee said Twitter hasn't taken the same aggressive approach to white supremacist contents because the collateral accounts that can be impacted are, in some instances, Republican politicians. So why is it so hard to kick the white supremacists off of Twitter? Well, because they sound, in their language, in the images they use, they sound just like white supremacists. I think it's time. Until the Republican Party changes, I think that it's time that the Republican Party is labeled for what it is. The what it practices in Congress and what it practices in the White House and what it practices on Wall Street, that stuff might be economic. But the stuff that it sells to its voters is pure hate and white supremacy. And I think it's long past time to label the United States Republican Party, just like the Klan, just like the White Knights, as a hate group. The United States Republican Party at this point in history is little more than a hate group. And I've got one more thing that I want to run past you. The president famously said that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't lose any supporters. I believe that. I also believe that the president could start killing Mexicans at the border, and he also would not pay a heavy price for that, or maybe any price at all. I also think that the president could set up concentration camps for Mexicans, and he wouldn't pay any price for that. Do I have evidence that he's doing this? Yeah, maybe.
That's right. So posit comitatus, maybe this is a term we can all use today. That is the act that keeps the military from enforcing domestic law. We can think of a lot of reasons throughout the history of human history about why you wouldn't want your military to be used in a way like a police force. Under that law, they could not be used to interact with immigrants because immigration is a domestic law. But it has been floated at the White House in recent weeks, the idea of using military to build tent cities to hold more migrants. As we know, there's been an influx in recent months. And there's also been some conversations about using them to run the detention camps, which would be in violation of that very law, posit comitatus. However, it is somewhat legal, or it is legal, to use them in a construction purpose. They think that this is a way that they could get these places up and running more quickly than going through the typical procurement process where you have to get a contract and go through the bidding process. You can use people who are already on the ground. And as we know, there are thousands of troops along the border already doing construction projects. They're putting wire over fencing. They're doing other things to secure the border. But if you put them in the places where they are running the camps, then you are in violation of that law. But it has been said, and we've seen over and over again, as this administration tries to go tougher, these ideas, even though they're illegal, they're starting to stick. And so it's important that we go over everything that's coming up, even those that seem like they couldn't stand up in a court of law, because at this point, it's not clear what the president might try.
The president has learned, no matter how bad it is, no matter how clearly illegal it is, no matter what black letter law that he has to break, he knows that he will not lose the support that he has from the Fox News viewers, the people that listen to white power radio, Fox and Limbaugh and Hannity and all this. He knows that he will not lose those people. And there is no limit to what he's willing to do. He knows that if he leaves office, it's incredibly likely that he will be indicted on dozens of charges. We'll get into that. Just a little bit. And so he's going to do whatever it takes to not leave office. I've heard plenty of people speculate that maybe it's a war. Maybe he's going to start a war, and maybe he's just going to get all those presidential wartime powers. But I think it's a little bit different, and I've not heard anybody assert this yet. Since he pays little to no price for what he does, I think he's going to go ahead and set up those concentration camps for the people that are coming over the border. And why shouldn't he? He knows that he'll get away with it. At a rally that he had this week, he joked about the idea. He says, why in other countries, they just shoot them when they come over the border. He said this. I'm not a direct quote. I'm paraphrasing. And someone in the crowd yelled, yeah, shoot them. And the whole rest of the crowd just laughed and patted each other on the back. Shoot them, kill them all, they said. This is a thing. This is happening inside your country. And if you don't notice those little things that are happening, sort of with a wink and a nod, you don't get to be surprised when concentration camps full of people from south of the border show up. We don't notice these things when they start because of all the little incremental steps. every step that gets taken just seems like a natural step over the last step. Just a little step here and a little step there and a little step there. No different than when a farmer sees his crops growing. Until one day, those crops are way over his head.
Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone?
I wouldn't.
Yes or no?
Could you repeat that question?
I will repeat it. Yeah. Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir.
The president or anybody else.
Seems you'd remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation, but...
Perhaps they've suggested?
I don't know. I wouldn't say suggest.
Hinted?
I don't know.
Inferred? You don't know. Okay.
So that was the top law enforcement officer in the Department of Justice, William Barr, being questioned by Kamala Harris. And after the Democrats... during William Barr's hearing, every time one of the Republicans got up, he just got him some good old verbal fellatio. But every time a Democrat got to ask their question, they asked him some questions that he didn't particularly care for. And Kamala Harris, boy, she gave that boy an ass whooping. So what you're hearing here is you're hearing Kamala Harris say, hey, are they asking you to investigate anybody? He doesn't want to say. Could you repeat the question? They asking you to investigate anybody. And he just wastes his time. They only get 5 minutes to talk, and he just doesn't answer the question. It's pretty clear that what Barr's job is to protect the president and not look out for the rule of law.
In reaching your conclusion, did you personally review all of the underlying evidence?
No, we took an accepted
Mr. Rosenstein?
No, we accepted the statements in the report as the factual record. We did not go underneath it to see whether or not they were accurate. We accepted it as accurate and made our...
So you accepted the report as the evidence?
Yes.
You did not question or look at the underlying evidence that supports the conclusions in the report?
No.
I'm not certain that Barr even read the report. I think he just got a bunch of these Trumpers together and they wiped out all the stuff they could that made him look too bad, left in some of the bad stuff. But it seems that his only job is to protect the president right now. So, Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer, who committed felonies for Trump, felonies that he himself did not benefit one iota from, things that only benefited Trump. He reported to prison this week, and Trump is still a free man. The headline, hundreds of former federal prosecutors say Trump would have been charged with obstruction were he not president. More than 370 former federal prosecutors who worked in Republican and Democratic administrations have signed on to a statement asserting special counsel Robert Mueller's findings would have produced obstruction charges against President Donald Trump if he were not the president. former U.S. attorneys going all the way back to Dwight D. Eisenhower. It was 370 at last count. It's even more now. They've said if he were not, he's a unindicted co-conspirator. He's the president. That's the only reason he's getting away with it. And what they're doing here is pretty Nixonian. I heard one say this week that Watergate This is worse than Watergate.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
If, in fact, a proceeding was not well-founded, if it was a groundless proceeding, if it was based on false allegations, the president does not have to sit there constitutionally and allow it to run its course. The president could terminate that proceeding, and it would not be a corrupt intent because he was being falsely accused.
That means that it is not illegal.
One president saying if the president does it, it is not illegal. Then the attorney general saying, hey, if he believes he's innocent, he does not have to go through the investigation. That's up to him. Would you feel that way about any president, Mr. Barr?
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I'm hoping that the American people have had enough, but I don't know. I really hope that this is enough for them, because I'm not certain how bad does it have to get. Quoting from Robert Freeman here. He lost the election by 3 million popular votes. The Russians helped him get elected by manipulating social media in critical electoral college states. He helped the Russians do that by providing them confidential polling data to guide their Facebook ad targeting. Those ads were seen by more than 100 million people when the total electoral college difference over the three states was 70,000 votes. Those involved with his campaign who were also engaged with the Russians lied repeatedly, both publicly and under oath, about the engagement. Many tens of millions of dollars mysteriously disappeared from his inauguration committee, and he feels no compunction to explain where it went. He brags about groping women, grabbing them by the vagina. Is there an honest woman in the country who admires that, who wants that? He's been credibly accused of sexual assault by more than 20 women. I said, but he's innocent. He didn't do anything wrong. He's innocent. He did nothing wrong, Melvin. He's an unindicted co-conspirator in the felony to commit election finance fraud by paying hush money to a Playboy bunny and a porn star. He's filed for bankruptcy 6 times, stiffing workers, contractors, and lenders for tens of millions of dollars. We also learned that during a 10-year period between the 80s and 90s, he lost almost $2 billion. Lost! Almost $2 billion. His resorts and other properties for years hired undocumented aliens, even as he railed against a tidal wave of illegal immigrants. He inherited $413 million from his father, much of it through illegal tax dodges, but pretends to be a self-made man. His charitable foundation was ordered to shut down after having been revealed as a sham, used to help promote his business and political interests. He claims he was a good student, but threatens to sue any schools that release his grades. He claims to be a brilliant businessman, but refuses to release his taxes, which would prove it or disprove it. He says the Mueller report totally exonerates him, yet refuses to allow it to be released or for critical witnesses to be able to testify about it. He's also fighting the full release as well as the underlying evidence. He grossly understated the value of his assets to dodge taxes while grossly overstating their value to secure bank loans. The Mueller report detailed 10 instances of obstruction of justice that would be criminal were he not the president, and so therefore immune from indictment. He's a pathological liar who's told more than 10,000 lies since assuming office. Literally, he's not able to deal with reality. His bootlicking of Putin at Helsinki, where he said he believed Putin about Russian interference in the 2016 election, but not his own intelligence chiefs. He has separated thousands of immigrant children from their parents, put them in cages, and lost track of them. He praised neo-Nazi marchers in Charlottesville 2 years ago and then re-defended them just a week or two ago. Though sworn to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed, he told immigration officials to break the law, promising to pardon them if they were convicted.
At least historically, pardons were always an act of presidential compassion and mercy, certainly how they were designed and intended. We have been talking for the last 22 months about pardons as an act of obstruction of justice and as evidence of intent. And now it seems, according to the Times reporting, and I can't wait to read it, that pardons are also a projection of presidential power in a policymaking role. And that's just hard for me to comprehend. It just doesn't fit with anything I ever knew about presidential authority or how presidents use pardons, as I said, for mercy and compassion.
He told senior White House aides to lie to the Mueller Commission about his efforts to obstruct the same commission's investigations. He smeared a Gold Star family whose son was killed in Iraq. He repeatedly smeared bona fide Vietnam War hero John McCain while he himself wrangled five draft Dodge deferments in the same war. He promised to help the working man, but immediately passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut that went almost exclusively to corporations and the wealthy. He continues to claim he's building the wall when not a single inch of new wall has been built. He promised to protect Social Security, but just 2 weeks ago submitted budget cuts that benefit millions, including seniors in poverty. He refuses to cooperate with the congressional hearings, trashing the constitutions and checks and balances at the very heart of our government. And I ask you, how bad does it have to get? Does he have to kill somebody on Fifth Avenue? Does he have to build concentration camps at the border? Does he have to get Ilhan Omar assassinated? What does he have to do?
How sad it is. How sad it is for us to see the top law enforcement officer in our country misrepresenting, withholding the truth from the Congress of the United States.
Madam Speaker, did the Attorney General commit a crime?
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law.
The head of the Justice Department, William Barr, has now been held in contempt for lying to Congress. I don't think that impeachment proceedings should immediately begin, but I believe that an impeachment hearing should, so that this information can get released right now to Congress. And it was Congressman Al Green, not that Al Green, Congressman Al Green, that was the first to say it immediately after Trump got elected. And it is Congressman Al Green that has now hit the floor again. But he's not saying it alone. This time he's got lots of other people saying it with him.
I rise, Mr. Speaker, to announce that I will bring articles of impeachment against the President of the United States of America for obstructing a lawful investigation.
And this isn't going to be hard. This isn't going to be exhausting. I just ran through about 40 or 50 things that this president has done that were illegal, dangerous, or immoral. And it's the illegal stuff that we can kick him out of there. The case isn't going to be that hard. But if this guy isn't worthy of impeachment, then nobody is worthy of impeachment.
A first-year law graduate, a baby prosecutor, could walk into case and prove this in his or her sleep. That is, and here is the kicker, Nicole. The president may have to run for re-election just to avoid being hauled into court for this. What does that tell us about his fitness to be our president for another 4 years?
I would love to gaga goo goo. I would love to see a baby prosecutor gaga goo goo. Trump is sorry, I shouldn't be goofing with this stuff. I'd love to see a baby prosecutor just get up there and shake his rattle at this guy. So one of the good things, unfortunately, is that all of our democratic laws, rules, structures, they've all been stress tested by this president because he's doing stuff that nobody's ever done before. But maybe we needed these tests. I know it sucks to go through this stuff, but you know what? I still feel like we're going to come out better on the other side. But when your kids and your grandkids ask where you were, who you were, how you responded during this time of what is officially a constitutional crisis, what are you going to say? Ladies and gentlemen, I don't have to say anything. They're right here on these tapes these tapes that I have no problem releasing to everybody. Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Find us on Facebook. Of course, you've probably already found us on Podbean or on iTunes. And I want to thank everybody so much for listening in. Questions, comments, hate mail, you know where to find us, tficpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform, but also to entertain and keep an open dialogue with you, the listener. Thank you for being here. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing. Congratulations, Kevin. And a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.